Welcome to New Letters on the Air. I'm Rebecca Presson. According to Newsweek magazine, our guest today is one of the best writers alive. Grace Paley writes only short stories, and she's published just three volumes of those. Paley's been quoted as saying that her political activism, she's involved in the peace and women's movements, has kept her from devoting the time necessary to write a novel. Although politics often find their way into a Paley short story, the author's characters have been described as ordinary people in unexceptional circumstances. Paley was born to Russian Jewish parents in New York in 1922, but she says she feels like she grew up in a small village.
If I were to describe where I grew up, I would say that I grew up in a one-half block area of the Bronx, which was dense enough with kids so that you didn't have to go half a block away. In fact, you didn't even know them. And they didn't know you. But at your end of the block, there was also a grocery store and a pharmacy and whatever, you know? Mm-hmm. So whatever was necessary for everyday life, you know, you went shopping every day. And I guess that's what one of the reasons I feel that I grew up in a small place. But nobody went to Manhattan. You were taken there to Radio City Music Hall. I mean, that's you know, it was sort of like any village person would go to the big town. And yet, our street was as dense as any city block could possibly be.
In the 1940s, Grace Paley studied at the New School for Social Research. In an interview with New Letters managing editor Robert Stewart, Paley says that W.H. Auden, who was then teaching at the New School, helped her find her voice as a writer.
He had just come to this country. I was about 17, and I had been had trouble at school, so I'd been made to go to work if I wasn't going to go to school. And I loved poetry already, and I loved him, and I took this course, but so did 200 other people. Mm-hmm. And he not only spoke English, but he also lisped. I mean, English, and lisped very hard. So I can't say I understood anything much that he said, but I did. I wouldn't have missed a class for anything, since he talked about literature. Mm. But what I did take away from it was an experience in which I gave him my poems, and we sat in the restaurant in Stewart's cafeteria, which is where he worked, and we looked at these poems, and he asked me if I used certain expressions. For instance, he said, "You always say, do you really say trousers? And do you use the word subaltern?" This was around the time when I said, "Oh, yeah, we do. Sometimes we do, you know." Mm-hmm. And, of course, after that, I understood that I was really writing exactly like him. And I was, you know, and I was using all these, this Bronx kid using all these British expressions. Mm-hmm. So I guess I learned to talk my own talk. It's the only way I can.
Is that why you started writing fiction rather than poetry?
Oh no, I didn't. I wasn't about to write fiction for another 25 years or 20, whatever it is, until I was about 35, 20 years. Yeah. It wasn't just that, but it's perfectly true that writing poems in those days, it was very hard for me to get away from literary influence.
Yeah, that's I think what I was interested in.
Yeah.
It took writing fiction in a way to find your own language.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. I think partly because in writing poetry, I was really always talking in what I thought was my voice, but actually, it's not until you, I've felt this on a lot, it's not until you really begin to speak in other people's voices that your own voice really knows what it's doing or knows what it can do. And gets interested.
This is New Letters on the Air, and our guest is short story writer Grace Paley. This story, titled Living, is from Paley's second book, Enormous Changes at the Last Minute.
2 weeks before Christmas, Ellen called me and said, "Faith, I'm dying." That week, I was dying, too. After we talked, I felt worse. I left the kids alone and ran down to the corner for a quick sip among living creatures. But Julie's and all the other bars were full of men and women gulping a hot whiskey before hustling off to make love. People require strengthening before the acts of life. I drank a little California Mountain Red at home and thought, why not? Wherever you turn, someone is shouting, give me liberty or I give you death. Perfectly sensible, thing-owning, church-fearing neighbors flop their hands over their ears at the sound of a siren to keep fallout from taking hold of their internal organs. You have to be cockeyed to love and blind in order to look out the window at your own ice-cold street. I really was dying. I was bleeding. The doctor said you can't bleed forever. Either you run out of blood or you stop. No one bleeds forever. It seemed I was going to bleed forever. When Ellen called to say she was dying, I said this clear sentence, please, I'm dying too, Ellen. Then she said, oh, Faithy, I didn't know. She said, Faith, what'll we do about the kids? Who'll take care of them? I'm too scared to think. I was frightened too, but I only wanted the kids to stay out of the bathroom. I didn't worry about them. I worried about me. They were noisy. They came home from school too early. They made a racket. I may have another couple of months, Alan said. The doctor said he never saw anyone with so little will to live. I don't want to live, he thinks. But, Faithy, I do. I do. It's just I'm scared. I could hardly take my mind off this blood. Its hurry to leave me was draining the red out from under my eyelids and the sunburn off my cheeks. It was all rising from my cold toes to find the quickest way out. Life isn't that great, Ellen, I said. We've had nothing but crummy days and crummy guys and no money and broke all the time and cockroaches and nothing to do on Sunday but take the kids to Central Park and row on that lousy lake. What's so great, Ellen? What's the big loss? Live a couple more years, see the kids and the whole cruddy thing, every cheese hole in the world go up in heat, blast, fire waves. I want to see it all, Ellen said. I felt a great gob making its dizzy exit. Can't talk, I said. I think I'm fainting. Around the holly season, I began to dry up. My sister took the kids for a while so I could stay home quietly, making hemoglobin, red corpuscles, etc., with no interruption. I was in such first-class shape by New Year's I nearly got knocked up again. My little boys came home. They were tall and handsome. 3 weeks after Christmas, Ellen died. At her funeral at that very neat church on the Bowery, her son took a minute out of crying to tell me, "Don't worry, Faith. My mother made sure of everything. She took care of me from her job. The man came and said so." "Oh, shall I adopt you anyway?" I asked, wondering. If he said yes, where the money, the room, another 10 minutes of good nights, where they would all come from. He was a little older than my kids. He would soon need a good encyclopedia, a chemistry set. "Listen, Billy, tell me the truth. Shall I adopt you?" He stopped all his tears. "Why, thanks. No. I have an uncle in Springfield. I'm going to him. I'll have it okay. It's in the country. I have cousins there." "Well," I said, relieved. "I just love you, Billy. You're the most wonderful boy. Ellen must be so proud of you." He stepped away and said, "She's not anything of anything, Faith." Then he went to Springfield. I don't think I'll see him again. But I often long to talk to Ellen, with whom, after all, I have done a million things in these scary, private years. We drove the kids up every damn rock in Central Park. On Easter Sunday, we pasted white doves on blue posters and prayed on 8th Street for peace. Then we were tired and screamed at the kids. The boys were babies. For a joke, we stapled their snowsuits to our skirts, and in a rage of slavery, every Saturday, for weeks, we marched across the bridges that connect Manhattan to the world. We shared apartments, jobs, and stuck-up studs. And then, 2 weeks before last Christmas, we were dying.
That's a wonderful, intimate, almost a family story.
Yep.
A lot of your stories deal with women kind of out there on their own. The men in the stories oftentimes are, if they're present at all, they have a kind of peripheral role. One of the stories that, one of your well-known stories, Faith in a Tree, I've been wanting to ask you about, because the little boy in there is, Richard, I think his name is so angry.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a comment that he makes, like, mostly nobody has fathers.
I think the other kid says that.
The other kid says that.
Yeah.
I was wondering, is Is Richard's anger, does it come from that fact that of a kind of a loss of parenting? It seemed to be an overwhelming feeling that I had.
Well, I don't know about that. I don't think psychologically. On the other hand, psychology might think me. So, you know, so I don't really know. I don't think I meant it that way. I think I just watched all these kids and how different they are. Like, the kid who says mostly kids around here don't have a father is not really an angry kid at all.
Mm-hmm.
And Richard is very, he is, that's true. But it could very well be. I mean, as I remember the father, as I've written him, I mean, they're not based on, the kids are based on kids that I know, and the life of Faith is her own life. It's not mine. I didn't live that life at all. I lived all my life with the father of my children.
Mm-hmm.
And, but it's true that that father goes off. I mean, I think he's first seen in I first wrote them and invented them in the first book, in The Little Disturbances of Man, in a story called The Used Boy Razors. And the father does go off a lot. But talking about where one lives, and one of the things that made me begin writing about these women was really just that interest in their lives, which wasn't mine, and I spent a lot of time with them, and I was very struck by their power, in a sense, and also their closeness.
Mm-hmm. Are these people that you sat with in the park and you just knew in the neighborhood?
Yeah, mm-hmm. And that was long ago. I mean, that I first it's as people think this business of mothers and children, single mothers, is a brand new thing. It's a brand new notice thing.
Mm-hmm.
But these, I was writing about these people in the mid-50s.
One of the strong themes that come out of your short story, A Conversation with My Father, is that the woman in the story believes that the world is open and there's always hope, mm-hmm. and the father doesn't. I'm wondering, this story goes back a while, if your view on the world would still reflect that, the themes in that story.
Well, you're kind of stuck with your disposition, mm-hmm. you know. It's almost as though it doesn't have so much to do with the facts of the case. I tend to be a kind of sad optimist, a half hopeless optimist in some kind of way. I think the argument with the father was a historical one. I mean, he came from a totally closed society, and she kept saying, you know, people do go to school when they're 45 years old, and that's true. I mean, to that extent, that is, there are wonderful things happening to people at older ages that didn't happen before.
Mm-hmm.
But as for the condition of the world, it's worse.
But you managed to look at it. There's a kind of a humor. I talked about this story with my students, and it was hard for them to actually pinpoint the humor. And yet, nevertheless, there is humor there. And I'm wondering, humor seems to be bound up in the irony of your character situations. Could you say a little bit more? Are you conscious of constructing humorous or ironic situations?
No, I'm not. I don't. I'm not conscious of it at all. It just is that it's a way of looking at it. It's a way that I probably developed early in life of looking at the world, and I think my father had that a little, so that there was some kind of a imitation of going on. But there is a way that for me humor illuminates what's going on. I mean, some people think of it as just, as my father thought of it, even though he was a humorous man, but when I was, he would say, just as in that story, he would say, yeah, jokes, that's you, you know. But there is a way, really, that humor broadens or illuminates, shines another kind of light on what's going on by showing disparities, because mm-hmm. humor is about disparities and contradictions.
That's the funny thing about I use the word, that's the funny thing about that story, because what you relate in the story is not funny.
No.
And yet it's the disparity that seems to be humorous.
Yeah.
It's one of the masterful touches of the story, and the father keeps saying, jokes, jokes, more jokes, and yeah. People are looking at it and saying, where's the joke?
Yeah.
But it is funny. You once said, as most readers know, that you haven't written a novel, and you once, I read a quote one time that you said, aiming at a novel was the wrongest thing I ever did. Why?
Well, I after my first book came out, I was still at a very obedient part of my life, and they said to me, now you have to write a novel. I mean, we've published this book of short stories for you, now you have to do a novel. So I thought, I was so grateful. I said, well, I should really do that. And I really worked at it for a couple of years and lost a lot of time, I think. Mm. Maybe not, you know, you think you're losing time, but, you know, you're not. You're learning something in that, something else. One of the things I learned was I couldn't write one. And
what's the difference? I mean, obviously they're different lengths, but
it isn't just the lengths. Yeah. It's that I couldn't get the form right. I couldn't get the. There was something so false about it. It was just false.
Mm-hmm.
It was. I felt like I was lengthening things that I could have easily said in a few pages.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't it about that time, it's only been recently, where the resurgence of the integrity of the short story mm-hmm. as a form itself has really grown? Because at one time, short stories were looked upon almost as children of the novel.
Right.
That you wrote short stories until you got around to writing
right.
the big book.
Mm-hmm.
Now people are beginning to understand the short story as an important form, again, in its own right.
It is, and it's much closer to the poem than it is to the novel.
Mm-hmm.
It has a lot more to do with that kind of, with that way of thinking. And stories that aren't like that are not quite right, I think, you know. But that's true. But at the same time, some of it is an idea that publishers had, you know. My book came out in 59 and Tilly Olson's book came out the next year, and Philip Roth's Goodbye Columbus came out the same time mine did. So they did publish a few of these books,
mm-hmm.
but they really didn't. They wanted us all to write novels immediately. But people do read and listen, mm-hmm. listen to short stories.
Yes.
There is a large listening audience that says, oh, tell me a story.
This is New Letters on the Air, and our guest is Grace Paley, who's talking with Robert Stewart. This story, read by Grace Paley, is titled Love.
First, I wrote this poem. Walking up the slate path of the college park under the nearly full moon, the brown oak leaves are red as maples, and I have been looking at the young people. They speak and embrace one another. Because of them, I thought I would descend into remembering love. So I let myself down, hand over hand, until my feet touched the earth of the gardens of Vesey Street. I told my husband, I've just written a poem about love. What a good idea, he said. Then he told me about Sally Johnson on Lake Winnipesaukee, who was 12 and a half when he was 14. Then he told me about Rosemary Johansson on Lake Sunapee. Then he told me about Jane Marston in Concord High. Then he told me about Mary Smythe of Radcliffe when he was a poet at Harvard. Then he told me about two famous poets, one fair, one dark, both now dead, when he was a secret poet working at an acceptable trade in an office without windows. When at last he came to my time, that is the past 15 years or so, he told me about Dottie Wasserman. Hold on, I said. What do you mean, Dottie Wasserman? She's a character in a book. She's not even a person. Okay, he said. Then why Vesey Street? What's that? Well, it's nothing special. I used to be in love with a guy who was a shrub buyer. Vesey Street was the downtown garden center of the city when the city still had wonderful centers of commerce. I used to walk the kids when they were little carriage babies, half asleep, maybe take the ferry to Hoboken. Years later, I'd bike down there Sundays, ride round and round. I even saw him about three times. No kidding, said my husband. How come I don't know the guy? Ugh, the stupidity of the beloved. It's you, I said. Anyway, what's this baloney about you and Dottie Wasserman? Nothing much. She was this crazy kid who hung around the bars, but she didn't drink. Really, it was for the men, you know. Neither did I drink. Too much, I mean. I was just hoping to get laid once in a while, or maybe meet someone and fall madly in love. He is that romantic. Sometimes I wonder if loving me in this homey life in middle age with two sets of bedroom slippers, one a skin of sandal for summer and the other pair lined with cozy sheepskin, must be a disappointing experience for him. He made a polite bridge over my conjectures. He said, she was also this funny mother in the park. Years later, when we were all doing that municipal politics and I was married to Josephine, Dottie and I were both delegates to that famous Kansas City National Meeting of Town Meetings, NMTM. Remember? Some woman. No, I said, that's not true. She was made up, just plain invented in the late 50s. Oh, he said. Then it was after that. I must have met her afterwards. He is stubborn, so I dropped the subject and went to get the groceries. Our shrinking family requires more coffee, more eggs, more cheese, less butter, less meat, less orange juice, more grapefruit. Walking along the street, encountering no neighbor, I hummed a little up and down tune and continued jostling time with the help of my nice reconnoitering brain. Here I was, experiencing the old earth of Vesey Street, breathing in and out, with more attention to the process than is usual in the late morning, all because of love, probably. How interesting the way it glides to solid, invented figures from true, remembered wraiths. By God, I thought, the lover is real. The heart of the lover continues. It has been propagandized from birth. I passed our local bookstore, which was doing well with the joy of all sex underpinning its prosperity. The owner gave me, a dependable customer of poorly advertised books, an affectionate smile. He was a great success. He didn't know that 3 years later his rent would be tripled. He would become a sad failure. And the landlord, feeling himself brilliant, an outwitting entrepreneur, a star in the microeconomic heavens, he would be the famous success. From half a block away, I could see the kale in the grocer's bin, crumbles of ice shining the dark leaves. In interior counterview, I imagined my husband's North Country fields, the late autumn frost in the curly green. I began to mumble a new poem. In the grocer's bin, the green kale shines. In the North Country, it stands sweet with frost, dark and curly, in a garden of tan hay and light white snow. Light white. I said that a couple of questioning times. Suddenly, my outside eyes saw a fine-looking woman named Margaret, who hadn't spoken to me in 2 years. We'd had many years of political agreement before some matters relating to the Soviet Union separated us. In the angry months during which we were both right in many ways, she took away with her, to her political position and daily friendship, my own best friend, Louise, my lifelong Park, PTA, and anti-war movement sister, Louise. In a hazy litter of love and leafy green vegetables, I saw Margaret's good face, and before I remembered our serious difference, I smiled. At the same moment, she knew me and smiled. So foolish is the true lover when responded to, that I took her hand as we passed, bent to it, pressed it to my cheek, and touched it with my lips. I described all this to my husband at supper time. Well, of course, he said, don't you know? The smile was for Margaret. But really, you do miss Louise a lot, and the kiss was for Louise. We both said, ah. Then we talked over the way the salt treaty looked more like a floor than a ceiling. Read a poem written by one of his daughters. Looked at a TV show telling the destruction of the European textile industry. And then made love. In the morning, he said, you're some lover. You know, he said, you really are. You remind me a lot of Dottie Wasserman.
In the past few years, you've been living more and more frequently in Vermont versus New York. I'm wondering, has that changed your... Have you seen any stylistic or thematic change in your writing since you've been living out in the country more and more?
Well, I've written a lot of poems about flowers. That's all I can say. I don't think the style has changed, but I think I've touched on a little horticulture and gardening a little bit.
You said earlier in the day that the only thing perhaps that you regret about your writing career is that you didn't write as much as you might have wanted to. Not that it's by any means finished, but do you write more up there?
No.
Do you have more time?
No. That has nothing to do with it, mm-hmm. really. Besides, I don't have more time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you're a person who fills up time, you fill up time no matter where you are. You know,
yes.
you can be in the there's as much to do there as there was for me to do in the city.
Well, I read a critic not long ago that said that the reason that you that your creative output wasn't as great as it might be is because you're so politically active, and that takes up so much more of your time. Is that correct?
Well, I think one of the problems is there are a lot of people who are let's say politically active, but I really one of the things I like about my kind of political life, which has nothing to do with the Democratic or Republican Party. One of the things I like about it really is the process, so that it's not just a question of having an opinion and going to a rally. Or to some other action, but this, I'm very interested, and I like very much the process of sitting together with people, and developing a way of acting, and developing a language for that action. Maybe it's only a flyer, or a statement, and doing it with them, and deciding what to do and how and the reasons for it and doing the analysis of it. So. And that's really different from signing a petition, which is a great thing to do. I mean, I don't knock any of it. It's just that what I tend to do is time consuming, and I do it. I don't even do it right now as much as I want to because I moved to the country and my usual group of people is in the city. But still, there are people up there in Vermont that I do work with in the same way, and that's how I'm interested in working. It's not worth it otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
Grace Paley was interviewed by New Letters Magazine managing editor Robert Stewart at KCUR-FM in Kansas City. Her books are The Little Disturbances of Man, Enormous Changes at the Last Minute, and, most recently, Later the Same Day. Copies of this and most New Letters on the Air programs are available on cassette for $8. Please send us your comments as well as the call letters of the station you hear us on when you write. Our address, New Letters on the Air, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. New Letters on the Air is produced by the literary magazine New Letters, which is edited by James McKinley. Assistant producer is Janice Woolery. Our studio engineer is Don Harvey. Gerald Kemner wrote our theme, and we receive financial assistance from the Missouri Arts Council. I'm Rebecca Presson.